Save big money on your bathroom update at Menards. Transform your bathroom with a stunning new vanity from Magic Woods. With over 100 options to choose from, our vanities combine contemporary style with durable materials. Find the ideal piece to create the bathroom you've always wanted. From stylish and elegant to simple and modern, save big money on Magic Woods vanities at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all our great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
At Home with the Hogs, sponsored by Arbolista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com. Hog, Penny Hog, at home with the Hogs.
Buenos dias, and a warm welcome. You're home with Penn and I, and we're delighted you can join us for another ration of our reflection of the week that's been on Talk Creator Radio Europe's magazine. Hi, babes. You there?
I'm here. One, two, three.
Frantically looking for something on her mobile phone, but anyway, there we are.
No, I'm not.
Now, as you may know, we're a big fan of the rain, and having spent 2 days next to the wood burner, today we sallied forth along a swollen river over two arroyos, made an intrepid ascent of the Crestalina, navigated the charcas of the Carretera, just to be with you. So what's the plan? Well, let's start by telling you about an amazing guest, a man with strange South American beasts.
That spit. Or do they? Alpacas. Alan Parks is going to talk to us about his wife, partner Lorna, are going to talk to us about alpacas. He does walking holidays with alpacas in Cordoba. And we're going to be talking to him at about 22:45.
Alan Parks and his inscrutable alpacas at home with us. Yes, in about 40 minutes from now. And before that, I'll be telling you the sad story of Xuan. Xuan is a Uyghur. And like many of us, Xuan emigrated to Spain. Unlike many of us, he can't go home. Can't go back to Xinjiang to see his sick mother or family. He's even been deprived of contacting his family because he's a Uyghur, a member of the Muslim community in West China that is being remorselessly persecuted by Peking. And actually, today's program has a distinctly migratory theme, as in the second hour, we're joined by the uncannily talented Joe Hepperwhite, and by the unique irrepressibility of Robbie Jeffries, to discuss the apparently banal feature we're calling life as a foreigner in Spain. What is it really like? Well, you might have some ideas on this, and we'll have the phone lines wide open. So do join us as we brainstorm brain-enlivening topics like your relationship with the language.
Your relationship with a bank.
Your relationship with bureaucracy. Your relationship
with everything.
Do you have a relationship with abandoned
dogs? Is it working?
And interestingly, we'll be considering your sense of where you call home. That's Joe and Robbie at home with us from 12:15 this very day. But before that, just after midday, Arbolista entertains us with what's on Arbolista today, Poppet?
Well, don't laugh. We're going to talk about the possibility of having a rock garden. There's a lot of rocks in Spain, and so we can make gardens with them.
That's brilliant. They don't need watering either, do they?
Well, they do a bit, yes.
Or weeding.
Could be the answer if you have a rocky outcrop as a garden.
Just converted into a rocky outcrop.
Little mini mountain. Yeah, we're going to talk about that and plants you can plant and how you can do it and various actually quite inspired ideas.
And we asked the question, do trees talk to each other? All this plus, say, marijuana-laced paella in Lanzarote. We shoot up on adrenaline holidays. We issue a warning. Beware of the suspicions of deep Spain. And talking deep Spain, we visit Teruel in Aragon and Puebla de Sanabria in Zamora, here in the heartlands of España Vaciada. We ask, where is everybody? Oh, and just a word, if you're offered a Swiss Patek Philippe watch for somewhere in the region of €1 million, express...
It's ours.
No. I was going to say, no, exercise caution. Actually, it belongs to the King of Morocco. At Home with the Hogs, we should be saying. Okay. At Home with the Hogs. Let's go to that story on the watch right away. A word of warning. If anyone offers you this, Swiss Patek Philippe. Beware. So what is a Swiss Patek Philippe, I hear you ask? Well, it is a uniquely valuable watch until last weekend, one of several in the collection of Mohammed VI, who is the king of Morocco. And incidentally, one of the, I think he's the fifth richest man in Africa. And it's time now to ogle for a while at the super rich. Last week, we sat in the back of the Rolls-Royce Cullinan, enjoying chilled champagne out of crystal-cut flutes, nestling our feet on lamb's wool floor mats, activating massage controls and positively feeling the music from a sound system that calls itself the Rolls-Royce Theatre Configuration. Well, today, let's say hello to Mohammed VI, one of the last absolute monarchs on earth, and he ascended the Moroccan throne 20 years ago, promising to become the king of the poor. 20 years on, he's doing pretty well for himself. The king owns 12 palaces, a castle in France, 600 cars, and 2 private planes, none of which he's exactly sharing with the poor, apart from the watches, among whose number used to be the Swiss Patek Philippe, which is valued at a staggering €1.2 million and is still missing, along with other artefacts from the royal palace in Marrakesh. Embarrassed security and police aren't sitting on their hands. The king wants his watch back, and stung by his wrath, the imperial bodyguard have rounded up a selection of suspects from the royal household, as well as an unfortunate jeweller or two, all of whom, some 25 in total, stand trial shortly in Rabat. So in the meantime, eyes peeled for a watch with a diamond-crusted dial the size of your face.
Do you remember that time we were in Morocco and we knew something? Every time we used to go to our hotel, you knew the king was about to arrive or had been recently, when basically there was a huge amount of flags everywhere. And that time that we went, and the road was lined, not only people, but a policeman about every 50 metres who stood there for hours and hours and hours. And then we pulled into the side of the road, we were flagged down.
We were.
And he went by in a helicopter. Was it, no, in a car with 5 helicopters either side of the car.
Yes, I mean, the actual procession took several hours to pass us.
Hours.
And we were passing it in its sort of increasing intensity. There was the sort of outer guard arriving, and then there were the motorbikes, and then there was a phalanx of helicopters. And the king was coming, and people were lined up alongside the roads, weren't they?
Yeah, insane. And you couldn't actually tell which car I had the king in, which is probably part of the idea, security. Shall I talk about
that? Do, darling, yeah, because January is the time for planning holidays, and I believe, I never get round to it, but how about an adrenaline adventure, in case you're not adrenalised enough already?
Well, you could take an 80-kilometre-an-hour zip wire across the River Guadiana from Spain to Portugal, with this heart in the mouth experience, as well as flying across the border. You obviously fly across the river, but you also land in Portugal, which is an hour ahead. Now, I've looked at their website today, and it's called Limit Zero. And what they do is they take you up in their jeeps to the very top of this sort of, well, it looks like a bit of a shaky shed, actually, zip you up to this cable and zoom off you go at high speed. I mean, it doesn't appeal to me at all, actually, and arrive in Portugal. It's very, very popular, apparently.
What a way to arrive in Portugal. I like that. We're going to Portugal, aren't we, at the end of February?
Yeah, not on a zip wire, we're not. Right.
Oh, I might see you there.
If you want another zip wire, though, Teruel, you were talking about just now, and it's one of Spain's forgotten corners, and it claims to have the longest zip wire ride in Europe, and it's 2 kilometres long.
Wow.
One zip wire, and that's to try and get tourists and people to visit. And what's not to like?
Really? No, I can do zip wires. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't mind heights, but being a tree climber.
It's just a long wee.
Yeah. No. It's 2 kilometres is a very long stretch. You can try heli-skiing in the Pyrenees, or this. A lot of people have done this, but you also need to book. And Joe, actually, who's coming in. After the hour has actually done this. She's done Spain's most terrifying mountain path, which reopened to the public in 2015 after being closed following a series of deaths in 1999 and 2000. I remember going past a sign to El Toro and you say, oh, let's take the kids there. And I'm thinking, no. This was about 20 years
ago. Well, that was back in the day when it really was a health hazard.
Yes. Sort of bits of the path missing.
Bits of the path missing, yeah. And mega drops.
So now it may now boast more safety features, but the path snaking along the side of the gorge in El Choro in Malaga is still not for the faint-hearted. I think there's even a glass bit.
Oh, really?
I think so, yeah. I'm too witty to do these things, so I'll leave that to the adrenaline junkies. Yeah, I'm all right driving. By the way, can I just say, anybody who's got friends visiting who've just arrived from the UK, just remind them, if they turn onto an empty road, wait for another car to go so they pass, so you know you're on the right side. I nearly got wiped out 2 days ago. It's becoming more prevalent, I think. People just driving on the wrong side of the road.
Just tuned out.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's coming along merrily, the wrong side of the road, straight towards me. He or she has not seen me. Mm. Beep, beep, beep. Mm. You know, lights and like, it was actually an English registered car. And I've done that myself, going back to Wales, turning onto the A40 briefly and thinking, wow, no, this is wrong. But yeah, so take care, everybody.
Easy to blank out. Now, on Wednesday, I was lunching in my favourite bar, La Cantina in Guadalmina. Hola, Carlos, Luisa, and me old mate Marco. I know they're listening. I was eating fabada, as you do.
Save our table, by the way.
Yes.
We're coming in, four of us.
Two right. Bewitched. By watching TV, eating fabada, bewitched by the inhuman perfection of a blonde newsreader as she relayed a flack of flood disasters from the Ebro and the Valencian coast. Without even a flickering change of expression, she then began telling the story of a mystery marijuana paella, which, due to the clamour of other diners, I couldn't actually hear. So, but I heard enough to only intrigue me. So I followed it up online. And the story is this. Exactly 3 weeks ago, Zakaria Mohamed Driss, the director of the Arrecife Driving School in Lanzarote, decided to take a dozen of his forklift truck pupils out to lunch. They were learning to drive forklift trucks so they could take the tests and then become qualified forklift truck drivers. Well, they all fancied paella and checked into a restaurant called Los Mojitos.
Los Mojitos, okay.
3 hours later, sick, dizzy and a little freaked out, they checked into hospital, where Dr. José Molino Rosa, after appropriate analysis, determined that the aspiring forklift drivers were too stoned to move. Two of them even stayed the night. Dr. Rosa also confirmed that the paella was to blame. It had been liberally laced with marijuana. You can imagine the hospital filling up with stoned forklift drivers. It's not really what the staff had in mind for a Saturday afternoon. But anyway, when the Policía Nacional arrived at Los Mojitos, later they checked licenses and paperwork and facturas, and bought food, and they took samples of ingredients and sent them to the health labs. They took statements from the cook and the staff, whom they noted were animasente hundido, which is Spanish for kind of out of it, really. They had also lunched on the paella. The police search of the restaurant found absolutely nothing. Neither the proprietor, the cook, nor the staff could remember or knew anything about doping the paella. They were animasente hundido, after all. Nor did the premises security cameras reveal anything. So, if you're in Lanzarote and fancy a paella, Los Mojitos remains open for business, but the marijuana paella is probably off the menu, and it remains a mystery. Suspicions of deep Spain.
Well, yes.
Talking about mystery.
In Spain, there's just a couple of things you've got to look out for. You must never put a hat on a bed, because it's going to bring you bad luck. And this could stem from the time when people believed that evil spirits lived in your hair. So they could easily be transferred from hair to hat to bed, resulting in evil spirits getting you in the night. Might be best to keep that hat on the hat stand, just in case. Don't ever buy family or friends knives or scissors as a gift. It's anything with a sharp end. Tradition says that the relationship will be broken. So think again about the set of knives you might have bought as a wedding present. Cactus. Have you ever thought about why there's so many cactus on Spanish windowsills? They ward off evil spirits. But one other thing, if you happen to be going to see a friend, never take them flowers. A Spanish friend, don't take them flowers, because it denotes funerals and death. Didn't know that, did you?
Yes, I sort of did. And I can't remember ever taking a bunch of flowers to a Spanish woman.
Particularly lilies. I mean, that would be a death.
Oh, lilies already.
Yeah, that would freak everybody out immediately. And
what about wearing a hat in bed?
I think if you probably kept the evil spirits
You've got the cactus on the windowsill. You've got your hat on your head and you're in bed.
Yeah, I think it's probably on your head. That'd be okay.
That's all right. Yeah. Right, okay.
And aren't there some various superstitions about priests? If you see a priest.
Well, the Gitanos are super, super superstitious priests. Curro, my Gitano friend who works with me, the other day he was driving down the street, passed the priest, the local priest, thoroughly inoffensive fellow, and covered the can of Coca-Cola that he had in the console, the open can of Coca-Cola he had in the console of the car.
I remember you saying that. That's just to protect the Coca-Cola?
To protect the Coca-Cola from...
You just could never fathom it, could you?
No.
We should talk about Mal de Ojo one day.
Mal de Ojo, yes. Yeah. Yes, that is a good... it literally translates as the evil eye. Now, if you're among the few tourists who have explored the mountains in the province of Teruel in eastern Spain, you may have noticed the bumper stickers and defiant graffiti promoting Teruel Existe. It's not a tourist slogan, but a cry for help from a land literally bypassed by the 21st century. High-speed rail, there's none. There's no direct motorway link to Madrid. And the best of the roads that do exist are potholed two-lane blacktops that wind through the dramatic scenery of a region that has become a case study for España Vaciada, empty Spain, a protest movement formed last year. The locals lament the fact that the province of Teruel has been bypassed by the 21st century, but for visitors, it only adds to the charm, says Chris Haslam in last week's Sunday Times. Well, I absolutely agree with him. I was in the died and gone to heaven fantasy of Albarracín. I don't know, maybe you've been there. It is one of the wonders of Spain. As I drove through the province 3 years ago, the place is an absolute dream world for a tourist, but the locals, the youth especially, are leaving in droves. The problems of España Vacía and rural depopulation find their nexus in Teruel Existe, the political party that surfaced to fight last November's election, and not without success. They have one member of parliament, Tomás Guitarte, whose recent story is an insight into the bitterly fratricidal world of Spanish politics. You see, he swung behind Pedro Sánchez with his one vote, that of his party, the one that stands up for not only Teruel, but all the diminishing communities that are withering in the pueblos and campos of the echoing interior. He did so in the face of a vicious campaign of personal threats from the extreme right, Hazte Oír, a group whose stated aim was that Pedro Sánchez would never govern Spain. Sánchez was at this time one vote short of investiture when Tomás Guitarte of Teruel Existe, now with police protection contra the intimidation of the far right, pledged his support for the new president, enabling his investiture in parliament. How successful Guitarte is in arresting the decline of rural Spain in his alliance with the new socialist government, only time will tell. But that's another story. What is clear is that we're losing a way of life as people flee to cities, exemplified by a place called Puebla de Sanabria, a comarca on the other side of Spain, 100 kilometers northeast of Zamora in Castilla y León. This is deep Spain. This is not popping over the coastal sierras into the hinterlands of Alcoy or Ronda to do your shopping. This is outback, seldom visited, España Profunda, remote and gorgeous, between Galicia and the Portuguese frontier. But the community of Puebla de Sanabria is not only hemorrhaging humans, it's becoming dehumanized. The church to the vital artery of the railway is now a ghost railway station. Trains still stop here, but the waiting rooms are locked. You can buy a ticket here, but only from a machine. It's not just the train, explains Raúl Barrado, alcalde of Malpartida de Plasencia, a not inconsiderable local town of some 4,000 souls. It's that health centres are closing. Chemists, clothes and food shops, says Señor Barrado. But nothing demonstrates the attrition better than the disappearance of the banks. Indeed, during the past 12 years, more than 20,000 rural branches have closed in Spain. And we're struggling to keep ours open, aren't we, babes, in Galicia?
Yeah, there's a financial administrator that comes in, and it's okay. But they expect the actual cash machines to do it all now. You can pay bills, you can pay your EV, you can pay in cash, which is actually quite efficient, but it's scary. You think,
It's not the same social vibe that going to the bank used to be with
God, no,
Antonio smoking Ducados in his office and loads of papers everywhere. He was doing property deals at the same time.
Absolutely.
Queues of people milling about and tellers who also had fincas somewhere up the valley. It's been stripped down, hasn't it?
Yes. Yes, it's international, really. It's worldwide. It's not just in Spain, really.
And it's partly that the internet offers an alternative to physical banks and shops. But the digital option is very much a double-edged sword, the death knell to many small businesses in rural Spain who just can't compete with online giants like Amazon. So they close. And the families for whom they were, the families who had a living through them, leave. I mean, it's a vicious circle. The last clothes shop in Puebla de Sanabria sports a sad notice of liquidation in what was once an optimistic display window for its owner, Jesus Centeno, 50 years old, to have to close the family business is un dolor del corazón, heartbreak. Primero de población y ahora encima la venta online, he remarks. First, depopulation, and now, on top of that, online sales. And stories like this put me in mind of those English villages with no school, no post office, no garage, no newsagent, no pub, no soul. By no way a concise comparison with Puebla de Sanabria, because houses in the home county dormitories are worth serious money. All those French villages you drive through that are apparently on lockdown, shutter tight, like the population had been gassed or at the very least deported. And the other thing that puts me, that comes to my mind is this recent conversation I had with a conspiracy theory prone friend that they want to herd us into cities where we are more easily controlled. So they are making life outside the city gradually more impossible. I mean, really, the sad tale of rural depopulation in Spain fits that script perfectly.
At Home with the Hogs, sponsored by Arbolista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com. At Home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
China now, and it might not be the time to visit what with the old coronavirus and all, but Penn has a welcoming tourist brochure for us, nevertheless.
It's an extract from the Beijing Hotel brochure, which was rather unfortunately translated, possibly using Google. Here we are. Getting there, this is to the hotel. Our representative will make you wait at the airport. The bus to the hotel runs along the lake shore, and soon you will feel pleasure in passing water. You will know that you're getting near the hotel because you will go round the bend. The manager will await you in the entrance hall. He always tries to have intercourse with all new guests. The hotel. This is a family hotel, so children are very welcome. We, of course, are always pleased to accept adultery. Highly skilled nurses are available in the evenings to put down your children, and guests are invited to conjugate in the bar and expose themselves to others. Please note that ladies are not allowed to have babies in the bar. We organise social games so no guest is ever left alone to play with himself. The restaurant, our menus have been carefully chosen to be ordinary and unexciting. At dinner, our quartet will circulate from table to table and fiddle with you. Your room. Every room has excellent facilities for your private parts. In winter, every room is on heat. Each room has a balcony offering views of outstanding obscenity. You will not be disturbed by traffic noise since the road between the hotel and the lake is used only by pederasts. Shall I stop now?
No, that's enough.
When you leave us...
Where is this place?
When you leave us at the end of the holiday, you will have no hope. You will struggle to forget it.
Sounds great. Talking of adrenaline holidays. Is that from a real brochure?
You can get these terrible, terrible translations.
Yes, well, we sometimes talk about Lost in Translation on this program, don't we? Now, you're live with us at Home with the Hogs on the 25th of January. Incredible to think that just a month ago, what was going on just a month ago? But can you remember?
No.
Well, it was Christmas Day.
Was that only 4 weeks ago?
And it doesn't the world feel like a different place to just a few weeks ago when the place was dripping with tinsel. Christmas decorations, I mean, how they've come on. I was in one of those hyper-viveros on the Costa del Sol last month, you know, a garden centre that thinks it's an airport terminal. I mean, I'd only come in to use the washroom and find myself in a winter wonderland, an acre of white-dusted synthetic Christmas trees, a frosted forest festooned with gaudy and enormous baubles and bubbles, some of which were the size of footballs. I mean, I remember the days when the typical tree bobble was no bigger than a golf ball. Now, huge bubbles. And it's all thanks to the Chinese, and in particular, a megalopolis called Yiwu, 300 kilometres south of Shanghai, where 60% of the world's Christmas decorations are fabricated all year round. 600 factories churning out tinsel, LED lights, bubbles and folding Christmas trees. There isn't any snow, there aren't any elves, just migrant labour working 12 hours a day for 300 euros a month, breathing a toxic concoction of glue, polystyrene snowflakes and powdered coating landfill, most of whom have only a confused idea about what Christmas is. Is it like New Year for foreigners, says 19-year-old Wei, a worker who came to Yiwu from a remote rural province. Which brings us on to the Chinese in Spain. Like you, maybe, a vital constituent in the wave of immigration that has all but transformed this country this century. Spain, of course, has undergone one of the most striking demographic shifts experienced by any country in Europe since the end of the Second World War. The transformation from an ethnically and religiously homogenous country to a multiracial nation of immigrants. I mean, between 1999 and 2010, Spain's population jumped from 40 to 47 million, a surge that was almost entirely explained by immigration. The number of non-Spaniards living in the country increased almost eightfold over the same period, from 750,000 to 5.75 million. Migrants arrived in unprecedented numbers, and they came from everywhere: Ecuador, Romania, Morocco, and from China. And the Chinese community increased from 14,184 in 1999 to almost 210,000 in 2017. I mean, of all the migrant groups, the Chinese are different. Although numerically, they're far behind the South Americans, the Romanians, and even the British, they are in many ways more visible and more successful than any other migrant group. I mean, wherever you go in Spain, from the Balearic Islands to the remotest village in Extremadura, you find an El Chino, a convenience store with long opening hours. You know the sort of place that some sell only food and drink, others cheap hardware goods, toys, kitchenware and clothing, and some sell everything all at once. More often than not, the Chinos are marvels of responsive retail management. You always seem to be able to find exactly what you need in their cramped, tightly packed aisles. And even without recourse to the sophisticated tracking and stock management technologies employed by big retailers, the owners know what their customers want and adapt their offerings accordingly. I mean, Chinese shops close to playgrounds offer a huge array of sweets and soft drinks. Keep the sugar levels up. Stores based in downtown Madrid, especially if they abutted parks and squares, stock vast quantities of beer, spirits, and crushed ice for young revelers who like to party outside. Now, I've been reading from a really excellent book that I recommend you. It's called After the Fall, and it's by Tobias Buck, who was Financial Times Madrid correspondent, books recently just come out, and there's a great understanding of the country in which we live. To go back to the Chinese, the majority of the Spanish Chinese are Han. That's the area that is Mandarin China. But all is not quite as rosy as if you're from a Uyghur from the remote desert province of Xinjiang in western China. Because like the Tibetans before them, the Uyghurs are now suffering. For over a decade, Peking has engaged in surveillance, repression and internment in a subjugation of this Muslim community of some 11 million people, an estimated 1 million of whom are locked up in what Peking calls facilities of re-education to counter terrorism and separatism. El País is the newspaper El País is one of 17 outlets, along with Le Monde, The Guardian and The New York Times, who have joined together to monitor the Uyghur persecution in Xinjiang in an attempt to that the Chinese, of course, have condemned as malintentioned interference. In Madrid, the Chinese embassy have warned El País that the situation in Xinjiang is within the rule of law and basically to back off, which for any observer of Peking's hysterical oversensitivity to any form of criticism will come as no surprise. But how does this situation impact on those from Xinjiang who have managed to get out, the Uyghur community here in Spain? Here is Xuan. Actually, he's called something else, but he's frightened to reveal his real name. And he's talking to El País. He's the fourth of eight siblings. He grew up in Xinjiang, which he describes as the world's second biggest desert, where everyone went to the mosque on Fridays and spoke Uyghur. Mandarin, the Han language, was on the school curriculum for four lessons a week. And stuffed sheep's lung was on the menu. So everything going along quite nicely, really, until the late 90s, when Peking offered huge grants to Han Chinese to move to the province in a major affront to this Turkmenistani Central Asian culture, which actually had nothing in common with the Han, apart from being under the umbrella of China. Certainly not in terms of religion or language. Thanks to his position as a state-employed engineer, Xuan's father was able to send him to university in Peking, and it was from there that he emigrated to Spain. The year 2009 coincided with the death of 200 Uyghurs in the town of Urumqi, following anti-Han riots. Immediately, there were radical changes in surveillance and control. Mosques were closed or destroyed. Those that remained did so for only for Muslims who were aged over 65. Stop and search interrogation by the mushrooming police force and the prohibition of the Uyghur language in schools were further repressive measures. Xuan did return home in 2016 to visit his mother, who was now on a dialysis machine, critically ill. To do this, he only managed to get permission to re-enter Xinjiang with a certificate from the hospital as proof that his mum was indeed sick. Since Xuan's return here to Spain, not only revisiting his family has been prohibited by China, but such is their level of paranoid control, the authorities have even stopped him communicating with his family. A last message from his father reads, "Do what you want in Spain, but don't cause problems for us here." A WeChat, that's the Chinese WhatsApp, he sent to his brother a year ago remains unanswered. And his last channel of communication, a Chinese resident of Spain who travels regularly to the region on business, recently told him that every time Xuan tries to contact his home, his family get fined by the authorities. He told Xuan they're frightened and can't afford the risks or the fines. It's best you leave them alone. Now, apropos of the brutal repression in Xinjiang, a month ago, you may have heard this, the Arsenal footballer, the Turk Mesut Ozil, spoke out against China's persecution of the Uyghurs, a Turkish-speaking Muslim community in Xinjiang, and his post translated as, "The persecutors are trying to separate them from their religion. They burn their Qurans. They shut down their mosques. They ban their schools. They kill their holy men. The men are forced into camps and their families are forced to live with Chinese men. The women are forced to marry Chinese husbands. But Muslims worldwide are silent. They won't make a noise. They've abandoned them. Don't they know that giving consent for persecution is in itself persecution?" So why this deafening silence on the plight of the Uyghurs from other Muslims? Well, I would suggest that it's the same reason that Arsenal FC have said nothing in support of Mesut Ozil. Don't upset Peking. They have the money. And such are the penetratively long tentacles of China's financial leverage that the state was able to punish Ozil's club, Arsenal, by removing their matches from the Premier League curriculum on state TV. Separating themselves from Ozil's post, the club's official line was that China remains vital to the Arsenal brand. But at what cost, I wonder?
At Home with the Hogs, sponsored by Arbalista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at SpainTree.com. At Home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Off to Cordoba now, where we join a man with a team of formidable South American herbivores from Walking with Alpacas. Alan Parks, good day and welcome home with the Hogs.
Good morning.
Good morning, Alan. What kind of weather have you got there? Have you had the storms?
We haven't had the storms. We've been really lucky for the last week, and it's even been quite dry, but today is horribly wet. But we haven't got hail, we haven't got snow, we haven't got lightning or anything like that.
So you're not like us, then, in that we celebrate rain? Like, phew.
Well, we do need the rain, obviously, but when I have to go out and deal with alpacas and stuff like that, I've also got an abundance of leaking roofs, so when it rains,
nice.
It's a lot
worse.
Yeah, what do alpacas think of the rain?
They don't mind, actually. Their worst weather is probably wind. They don't like it when it's windy. They sit down to get away from the wind, but their wool really sort of gives them insulation, so their actual bodies stay dry, so they don't mind the rain.
Okay, yeah, they have... I was going to ask you about the wool, Alan, but first of all, can I just ask you how long you've been living in Cordoba, and did you arrive with the idea of doing alpacas or walking with alpacas?
Well, we've been here 12 years, almost exactly 12 years, middle of January. We decided to move. We used to live in Brighton in England, My partner Lorna had... she had a dance school for 30 years, but then she got ill.
Yeah.
She's got an illness called sarcoidosis, which meant she had to stop doing what she was doing.
What's that illness called? Sarcoidosis?
Sarcoidosis.
Right, what's that? Diverting.
It's an autoimmune disease.
Oh, right, okay.
The way it affected her was it caused granulomas in her lungs and it made like working difficult and stuff like that.
Sure.
So,
not ideal for dancing.
We had to come up with a new plan.
And you did.
yeah, we did. So we decided we would move away.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with this off-grid old olive mill, which is what we eventually bought. And we'd seen an alpaca in a zoo, just one alpaca on its own. It was a really ugly creature. We didn't even know what it was at the time.
Yeah.
And... then we started seeing them everywhere and we started doing a bit of research. And at that time, it was literally just before the crash. So we're talking 2006.
Yeah.
There was a huge amount of money being pumped into alpacas in the UK and in the US. And we thought, wow, they've just started in Spain. There's just a couple of farms. Why don't we do that? That'll be good for money. And that's how it started.
Yeah, sounds a bit like us, actually. How are we going to get rich?
Yeah, except
exactly,
you did.
Yeah.
Did you? Are you rich, Alan?
No.
His roofs are leaking, hun. He can't be that rich.
No. Yeah.
Our roofs don't leak.
Calm down, calm down. Yeah.
But
how do you make any money from alpacas? I mean, are they your main source of income?
In a way, in sort of sideways, if you like. Initially, our plan was to breed them and sell them. But, of course, with the crash, lots of expats went home and things like that, so no one had any money. So over the years, I've branched out. I've actually written books about our life here in Spain, so there's books available on Amazon about us.
Oh, yeah.
That helped for a few years. I'll plug it if you like. Seriously, Mum, What's an Alpaca? Was the first one.
Please plug it. I was going to ask you if you could plug it, but seriously, Mum.
Seriously, Mum, What's an Alpaca?
What's an Alpaca?
Seriously, Mum, What's an Alpaca? And then obviously you can find the other ones on there.
Oh, brilliant.
By Alan Parks, or do you have a nom de plume?
No, because it's a book about our life, I thought it best to write it under my own name.
Not yet. That's a false pretense.
Great, I love that, yeah. And that talks about how you set up here and arrived at your olive mill in Cordoba.
Our adventures with the animals, yeah, and like what's happened. Because obviously we'd had a dog when we lived in England, you know what I mean? So we were coming over and starting a whole new thing. So lots of things happened to us. Some sad, some happy, and it was just something that I felt needed to be written down, and it was a way to tell people.
I've lost the significance of the dog. What happened to the dog?
No, the dog came with us, but
good.
All I'm saying is that was all we'd looked at, you know, animal-wise, that was all we had when we were in the UK. So then we came here and we started a farm with alpacas. It was quite a leap from just having a dog to then having alpacas.
And to having how many alpacas?
We started with 4 pregnant females.
Wow. Okay. Wow. So, Alan, just if people aren't aware of them, I mean, we've got alpacas in our valley, and we have a neighbour who breeds them, who I think you know. But what's the difference between an alpaca and a llama? I was going to ask you. I mean, llamas, they're bigger, aren't they?
Yeah, so llamas are probably about 2/3 bigger than an alpaca. An alpaca generally weighs about 75 kilos, so they're not huge, they're not sort of intimidating or anything like that. A llama can weigh about 200 kilos,
right?
So it's quite a big difference in that respect.
Okay.
But the biggest difference would be that alpacas are purely bred for the quality of their wool.
Right.
And llamas are bred as pack animals, so what they've come from is so that they can carry things.
Oh, okay. So you can't ride an alpaca then. You can't, you can't get just saddle and pack. So and llamas, would I be right in thinking that they sort of look after sheep? Well, they sort of guardians.
Sometimes, and it depends on the country. So here in Spain, you could have alpacas actually looking after sheep. In the UK, you can have alpacas looking after sheep.
Oh, okay.
In the countries where there's bigger predators, like the US or Australia, they tend to go for llamas or even bigger animals, donkeys and dogs and stuff like that.
Really?
But
in
the UK and Spain, we don't have huge predators.
Okay.
So they could be used here generally to ward off foxes and things like that.
Right, so it's foxes and dogs. Would they deal with dogs?
Reasonably, a pack of dogs. There's quite a lot of incidences that happen, even in the UK actually. If a pack of dogs gets out, like a pack of stray dogs, they will attack alpacas. So that can be a problem.
So alpacas can be intimidating. I think you've just said that. How do they...
Llamas can be.
I've been intimidated by an alpaca. Have you been intimidated by an alpaca, Alan? Like, don't they spit? They spit? And they've got razor-sharp hooves, haven't they?
No, let's
do they rear up?
Let's razor-sharp hooves.
No.
This is not good for business.
They can spit.
No, I'm respect. Yeah, respect to the alpaca, man. Respect. I like herbivores that can stand up for themselves. You know, they're a kind of bullied caste, and I think it's great when a herbivore can turn around and say, do you know what?
Yeah, I know what you mean. They've got a good kick on them, but they haven't got claws. They've just got toenails. So essentially, like a person, you have to clip their toenails every so often. But spitting is something they can do. Now, they've got a bit of a bad rap for spitting because people think any time they see an alpaca or a llama, they're going to get spat at. It's not really that. It's more a defensive thing.
Yeah, more if they cross.
So what sort of form does this spitting take? I mean, how unpleasant is it if you get... spat at? Have you been connected with spittle, with alpaca spittle?
Yeah, the worst incident I've had of it personally was we had a baby that was just starting to eat food from a bucket, and he got the bucket caught over the back of his neck. So I didn't think anything of it, and I just grabbed him to take the bucket off.
Yeah.
And his mum went ballistic at me, sort of thinking I was going to hurt him.
Whoa.
And literally chased me around the paddock and covered me from head to toe with the contents of her stomach.
Oh, so it's deep. It's deep spittle. It's sort of regurgitated
it's
bile.
Horrible.
Excellent. Right. Excellent.
It's just one
corrosive.
If it's but if it's just one bit, it's not that bad.
Okay. But Alan, talk about what we were talking about? Is the lovely walks you do with alpacas. It's not a dangerous sport. If we could just change tack here slightly, because I want to encourage people to come and see you, which indeed we might.
I'm well wrapped up with this.
Well, you've got the ones down the lane from us. You'd be nice to those.
No,
first.
I want to go and see Alan.
Okay. So, Alan, tell us what you offer.
Okay, so essentially we started a few years ago offering what we call an alpaca experience weekend.
Yeah.
So it was aimed at families, and they would come up, stay a couple of nights. We cook for them, we do evening meals, and we do breakfast. And they get some alpaca time in that. So we would take the alpacas for a walk, and the kids can feed the animals and that sort of thing. Now, in the last couple of years, alpacas have become really, really fashionable, and it's literally something that is coming on people's bucket list, that they want to meet an alpaca, they want to kiss an alpaca, this kind of thing.
Yes.
So we've just started offering just alpaca walks, so people can come and do an alpaca walk. They can still come for the weekend if they want, but they don't have to commit themselves to a whole weekend. They can just come for an hour or 2 hours.
Oh, sounds fantastic. Alan, I'm so sorry. We're running out of time.
We just want your contact details, Alan. Just tell us how we can find you.
Find me on Facebook. That's the best way. Our Facebook page is called Experience Alpacas in Andalusia, or my name is Alan Parks.
Okay, I'm going to put something on our Arbalista website as well. I mean, our Facebook.
Yeah.
So, Alan, I'm so sorry to cut you short.
Yeah, sorry, it's been so
fascinating.
Brief. Really, really cool to talk to you.
Really good.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Alan.
And we'll definitely come and see you.
Okay.
I'm up for it. Yeah.
Enjoy the rain.
I'll look forward to that.
Have a good one.
Thank you.
Fantastic.
Bye, Alan.
That's Alan Parks from Walking with Alpacas. Coming your way after the news, Arbalista brings us rockeries and trees that talk to each other, and then we have a jolly expat forum. Don't miss this open floor, open mic with no holds barred on just what it's like to be a foreigner in Spain. We'll see you right after the news.
Mr. and Mrs. Hogg, sponsored by Arbalista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com. With the Hogs. With the Hogs. With the Hogs.
We plough the fields and scatter the good seed on the land.
Yes, indeed. And welcome to the part of the program we call Arbalistas, Palms, Trees and Gardens. And today we're going to feature something that is essentially low maintenance and plentiful in a land as stony as Spain. Have you ever thought of a rockery in your garden?
Have we got a rockery? We've got sort of high stone walls, which actually almost rockery. I think.
But they've got plants growing out of them, so
yes,
you could call them rockery.
You go for any walk anywhere in Spain, the chances are you'll come across stone, and particularly in the spring, some kind of vegetation growing out of it. You've got wild rosemary, you've got wild thyme, and plants which are indigenous to here, not necessarily indigenous, but that do very well here, which you can recreate that same feeling in your own garden.
With rocks.
With rocks. Rocks. Yes. Or indeed, if you live near the sea or the river, with pebbles. So, or big river stones.
The rocks are a big deal here. You've only got to go to Viveros to see those crates of volcanic rock.
Yeah.
That are very popular.
Yes.
I actually don't
like
them.
You see a lot of gardens, don't you?
You brush against them with your leg and wound up with a sort of lacerating wound. And I was staying in a house in Mallorca last summer where they'd gone to town with volcanic rock. They'd
built volcanic,
yes, all sorts of features in the garden, like little sort of lighthouses that you trip over made of sharp-edged volcanic rock. Walls with some volcanic rock.
Tumbling rockeries with lots of succulent growth in between, really. I'm just thinking of not bare. So basically, if you're not quite, you want a little bit of a level in your garden, you don't want it all sort of flat, or you want to make a space where you could perhaps have a little rock pool in the middle. It's easily done. Now, you don't have to have, you know, huge, great big stones in there. You can create. If you imagine your garden now, if you're looking, say you've got a square garden, you sort of look at the back corner, for example, and you think, okay, you could soften that corner and put in a nice curved space and a little bit of height at the back, and there you can make your own, you know, your own little rockery. That's what you call them in England, isn't it? Rockeries. And there's it's a really sweet little website that I found, which actually talks about rockeries and different ways and different features that you can make within them. Like, for example, a mosaic. If you get nice pebbles from the beach with the greys and the whites, you can do some lovely fan patterns, which if you are a fan of pin interest and all that kind of stuff, or, you know, these fashion things, I have to admit that I don't. You can pick up a few ideas for designs and sort of, well, the best thing to do is to visualise it on a piece of paper, and then to get out there and maybe get a bit of help and to do it yourself. So you can make a mosaic, or you can make a little more of it. If you live in a very dry area like Murcia, you can make a sort of more of a desert inspired rock garden, with succulent plants and with cacti sort of delicately placed in there. So which makes it look more of a desert landscape. And obviously you wouldn't have the pond there. And that's, you can put in your pretend gecko. another thing that you can do is make a really nice a spiraling rock herb garden, which means that you can have herbs are so important and so nice to have. Just to go outside, I'll just go and pick up some rosemary, for example, and you can make a herb garden where you've got it within the rockery. I think another thing that you could, what I want to talk about now is, because I know we're always a little bit too much of a hurry for our ballista, is rock mulch. I remember doing a permaculture course years ago, and that involved growing plants in the desert or in very, very hot places. And actually, if you have rock or stone, that is a very good protection for plant roots. You also have to have very, obviously, good drainage, but it's good protection from scorching sun to have stone. It's better than nothing. It just stops that compaction. We do that sometimes in those payanas for those newly planted trees, don't we? But that... Right,
yes,
there's that kind of
effect. But doesn't stone heat up?
But
I'm thinking
underneath...
of walking across sand on the beach.
Yeah,
where
but
you
if you were
can't...
a frog, where would you go? If there was a stone, you would go under the stone. It doesn't...
Bigger stones.
Bigger then. Stones, yeah,
yeah.
Bigger stones.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Big stones, yeah.
Okay, and you can also... So what you need to do is to obviously do a bit of research how to build your rock garden, but you need to clear your plot of land... You have to plot your design. You've got to have some idea of what you're going to do. Not too random, otherwise you'll end up with a mess. And choose the type of rocks you want to have. And I know that sounds silly. I mean, you were talking about volcanic rock, but you don't want to mix for the sake of beautification. You don't want to mix all different types of stone. Stick to one type.
And really? Do you think so?
Yeah, well, I think it just looks better.
And that then, surely is down to taste.
Well, yes, okay, but I think it's more tasteful to have all in one stone.
You made it. You're right. So you're from the uniform rock.
I am. I am.
School of garden design.
I am.
I think I'd like a geological variation in my garden.
Yeah, would you? Okay. Well, I think the other thing that you need to consider with a rock garden is that the plants you're going to have. And a good rule of thumb to follow in finding plants for your garden is to pick small ones that take drought well. Tiny bulbs and succulents look great on these gardens, and you can also consider creeping plants. You can get the horizontalis thyme, the horizontalis rosemary, I know I keep going on about, and lavender. That's not the, that doesn't creep along, but they are really, really nice for in between rocks. But don't restrict it with small plants. Big plants can also look great depending on your desired style. Now, remember that rock gardens are fairly permanent structures, so you should take note of that as you find an, so make sure you find an excellent spot. If you're starting up, then a reasonable place to start is in one corner of your backyard or your garden. If you're feeling more experienced and ready to take on a big challenge, you can try out using larger spaces and a higher hills. Are we inspired there, Gilly?
Yes, I'm loving the idea of rocks.
No, you're not.
No, what I love about rocks is they are low maintenance.
They are very low maintenance, yes.
They're drought resistant.
Yeah, and obviously...
They do a lot. They're not kind of dynamic.
Exactly.
Like,
oh, so
well,
that's
rock's
why you
taken,
have...
hasn't it?
You used to be able to get pet rocks, didn't you?
You did too,
you did.
Yes.
We all had pet rocks in the 80s. Yeah.
Right, now, 2020 is the year of the tree, and there's a recent book by a German forester that has the potential to revolutionise the way we relate to them. His name is Peter Vorleben. The book is called The Hidden Life of Trees, from which I'll be reading to you from time to time over the next few weeks. And as an introduction, here is a foreword to the book, and it's written by the plants man Tim Flannery, and it kind of sums up what this book is about. Tim says, "One reason that many of us fail to understand trees is that they live on a different time scale than us. One of the oldest trees on Earth, a spruce in Sweden, is more than 9,500 years old. That's 115 times longer than the average human lifetime. Creatures with such a luxury of time on their hands can afford to take things at a leisurely pace. The electrical impulses that pass through the roots of trees, for example, move at the slow rate of 1/3 of an inch per second. But why, you might ask, do trees pass electrical impulses through their tissues at all? Well, the answer is that trees need to communicate, and electrical impulses are just one of their many means of communication. But trees also use senses of smell and taste for communication. Can you believe this? If a giraffe starts eating an African acacia, the tree releases a chemical into the air that signals that a threat is at hand. And as the chemical drifts through the air and reaches the other trees, they smell it and are warned of the danger. Even before the giraffe reaches them, they begin producing toxic chemicals. Insect pests are dealt with slightly differently. The saliva of leaf-eating insects can be tasted by the leaf being eaten. In response, the tree sends out a chemical signal that attracts predators that feed on that particular leaf-eating insect. Life in the slow lane is clearly not always dull. But the most astonishing thing about trees is how social they are. The trees in a forest care for each other, sometimes even going so far as to nourish the stump of a felled tree for centuries after it was cut down by feeding it sugars and other nutrients, and so keeping it alive. Only some stumps are thus nourished. Perhaps they're the parents of the trees that make up the forest of today. A tree's most important means of staying connected to other trees is the wood wide web of soil fungi that connects vegetation in an intimate network that allows the sharing of an enormous amount of information and goods. Scientific research aimed at understanding the astonishing abilities of this partnership between fungi and plant has only just begun. The reason trees share food and communicate is that they actually need each other. It takes a forest to create a microclimate suitable for tree growth and sustenance. And that, incidentally, this is me talking, not Tim. That, incidentally, is why trees sometimes struggle in isolation in gardens. You've taken them out of their normal forest environment and planted them on a lawn or something on their own. They feel exposed, don't they, babe? So, and Tim goes on to say it's not surprising that isolated trees have far shorter lives than those living connected together in forests. And perhaps the saddest plants of all are those we've enslaved in our agricultural systems. They seem to have lost the ability to communicate. And as Hualeben says, are isolated by their silence. Perhaps farmers can learn from the forests and breed a little more wildness back into their grain and potatoes, Hualeben advocates, so they'll be more talkative in the future. So that's the foreword of this remarkable book. It's a beautiful read. It's called The Hidden Life of Trees by Peter Hualeben, who used to be a forester in the north of Germany. And he was detailed by, for 20 years, he worked in this forest, and he was detailed by the owners of the forest, or the authority managing the forest, that he was to fell the beeches because they were now mature. And in a Damascus moment, the forest revealed itself to him as a sort of living ecological system that was in some way sacrosanct. And Peter Hualeben persuaded the authorities that the trees were better off where they were. And now the forest actually makes a sustainable living from people who visit it and enjoy it in a way that we should enjoy a forest. Finally, on Arbalista's Palms, Trees and Gardens, are cypress trees a fire retardant? Now, I know we're a long way from fire season, particularly with this beautiful rain we've just been having. But, of course, fire is never far from our minds, particularly with the nightmare that is going on in Australia. So there's this idea that cypress trees are potentially a fire retardant. An investigation is underway as to why a copse of cypress trees was the only vegetation to have survived a wildfire that destroyed acres of forest in the hills around the Valencian town of Andija last summer. Aerial images show the devastation of about 50,000 acres, except for a vibrant patch of green where a group of around 1,000 cypress trees still stand tall. And despite the fact that the trees were planted close together, and maybe because the trees were planted close together, their branches intertwined, the flames did not advance through them, and only 12 out of the 958 trees showed any fire damage at all, while all around the native tree species such as pine, home oak, juniper and gorse were destroyed. The mystery and what it might mean has sparked a debate over forest regeneration, with some experts advising that cypresses should be planted in areas prone to wildfires to act as a natural firebreak. The trees acted like a screen against the fire, said Bernabe Moya, the director of forestry in the Valencia region. They could be planted strategically between 3 and 15 lines of cypresses to reinforce the firebreaks in hard-to-reach areas. Now, I've got a theory on this.
Yeah, what is it?
Well, the theory is that if they're planted closely together, cypresses, because they're so dense, they will actually inhibit fire. Imagine you've got...
Because it can't breathe.
Imagine you've got a fire going.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. There's no oxygen. Okay. So fire needs air in which to burn. But if a fire approaches what is effectively a dense blanket, even though it's made of twigs and cypress sprays, it doesn't have the air to breathe, and so probably those trees that were damaged were the trees that were to the exterior of the group.
And they just happen to be cypress because they can grow that close together.
Yes. Okay. One up for the much maligned cypress tree.
Okay, do we know what kind of cypress it is?
It would be a Mediterranean cypress, yes.
A Mediterranean one.
A Stricta or a Monterey cypress, yeah. That's all for this week's Arbalista's Palms, Trees and Gardens. We'll be back sometime around this time next week. We'll see you then.
Mr. and Mrs. Hogg, sponsored by Arbalista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com.
At home
with the Hogs. With the Hogs. With Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Now, one of the axioms, the cornerstones of what we talk about at Home with the Hogs, has always stemmed from the fact that most of us who are engaged with the show, listeners and contributors, have jumped from the known to the unknown. And this, of course, is the stuff of emigration and forms a circumstance which somehow binds us. So rather than continue to make oblique references to this state of affairs, today we thought we'd take the expatriate bull by the horns and ask a question we hope resonates with you. What is life as a foreigner in Spain really like? And we could think of no one better to assist us with in our inquiries than the much loved and regular contributors to this programme, both resident here in Spain, of course, Joe Hepperwhite and Robbie Jeffries. Joe and Robbie, very nice to see you.
Good morning, guys. Well done for making it.
I know.
Nice trip.
Lovely trip, thank you.
We loved it.
So we said the studio's next to the big Whopper. You went to another...
A different Whopper.
Another one. not a word of a whopper. Now, before we begin our discussion, I will acknowledge that the four of us are English, so cannot even attempt to universalise the expat and migrant experience in Spain. And I wonder how different that must be for a Venezuelan or a Moroccan, or, as we've just highlighted, someone from China. Whatever one's own experience, it can only be subjective, and that's why it's interesting. It's personal and unique to you. So if you want to tell us about it or join the discussion, please reach for the phone 952-784-1000. Now, of course, if you are a Venezuelan or a Colombian or an Argentinian for that matter, living in Spain, you won't have a problem with the language, which you can't necessarily say about us Brits. And it's the language, the speaking of Spanish, that we want to start with. Joe, how do we relate to the Spanish language?
Well, I think I might be right in saying as that probably most people get by. It's definitely true. I know this from... being a language teacher myself, that you acquire the language that you need. So
that's
you're always
so
going to learn
so
what's
true.
Essential to you. Yeah. So no doubt, Kit and Pen, you know all kinds of expressions to do with pruning and trimming and clipping because of your arbolista
And tools occupation. And
wheelbarrows.
My brother, who's a bit of a handyman, I think he can name everything in the ferreteria in Spanish. He can ask for hinges and flanges and brackets and goodness knows what else. But he's still not that great at talking about something that happened in the past.
Or in the past tense.
I mean, you know, or to say something like... I would have asked him if he had been there. I don't think any of us could really do that one. But we do learn what we need, I think. I mean, I can ask for a beer in many languages. Several, probably. Because you learn the language that you need for your lifestyle.
Do you
think that's true, Robbie?
Yeah, I do. I mean, a beer is one thing. You know, you have to be a little bit more careful when you delve into the Spanish language. The thing to do is to sit there and listen and do your best to try and understand. Don't try and be a linguist if you're not a linguist. The Spanish, or the locals where we live, certainly in Galicia, really appreciate you having a go.
Yes, but, I love that about the Spanish. I think that's great. We've got Janet on the line. Hi, Janet. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How is everybody?
We're good, thanks. Yes.
How are you?
Slightly on edge, you know.
You're in Mallorca, aren't you, Janet?
Yes.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning.
Morning, Janet.
Of course, you have the two different things here in Mallorca. You have the Castellano and you also have the Mallorquin. They are very different also. So you have to learn, for example, I'm working. Estoy trabajando. Or... Faena, which is in Mallorquín. So you have this sort of double problem here. But I find that people don't make enough effort. I'm sorry, but I can say that I speak fluent Spanish. Because I've made the effort.
How long have you been here, Jana?
42 years.
Well,
nearly 43. But I could speak after the second year, I was basically fluent.
Right. That's unusual. Yeah.
Yeah, because I had people helping me. I'd say, well, look, you know, the verb to be. Now, as we're on the road, tell me the verb to be. Yo soy tú, eres el, and all this. And so I was doing the verbs. And once you get the alphabet right and you get the IR, ER or OR endings of the verbs, you've got the basics. And then from there on, you can say, me gustaría, and use all the would like and would have done, hubiera hecho, and you can build up on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I think it's making an effort more than anything, and it's very easy to say, well, with that, I can get by.
I know
people that have been here for 20 years and can hardly say a word in
Sure.
And I think it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
Janet, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Janet obviously enjoys speaking Spanish. Robbie, do you enjoy having a go?
I love having a go. I'm quite happy. When you're learning a different language, you have to be prepared to make a fool of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. You're going to do something. You're going to confuse, the two chickens, you know, the pollo and the other one. And you could ask...
What other one?
Pollo. You could ask for...
Gallina.
Yeah. You could ask for a plate of completely different.
Right, I get it.
Be prepared for somebody to have a little giggle at your expense. Mm-hmm. It is funny, but you're never going to learn any other way.
I think a lot of Spanish words have an equivalent body part, don't they?
They do.
They do.
And I think that's important. So go up and have a go. Join various different clubs. You know, don't be scared. Go and join. I'm in a gym spinning class with 10 Spanish ladies, all with an opinion. And it's great. And two of them become great friends of mine. And I think that's useful because they'll correct my Spanish. And they also tell me a lot more dirty words, which is quite useful. But on a serious note, have a go. You live in a foreign country. It looks good for us as a nation of people that we are not the perceived ignorant people that the English tend to get the reputation of by not learning language.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And it is true that risk takers make better language.
And do we feel?
Oh, really?
Do we feel? I'm going to bring Sharon in here. Good morning, Sharon.
Good morning, everybody. Yeah, I would agree with Janet actually. And Janet, by the way, if you're listening, I agree with you that there's awful insulting promos on TRE at the moment. I find them embarrassing.
What are those, Sharon?
The promos about what they do, the traditions in Spain about shouting Oiga and all this and that and the other, and Janet's lived here for longer than I have, and she said they're just not true to life. So, but anyway, I'll move on.
Right, so that's sort of stereotypical.
A few years ago, when I was robbed here, and we went to the Guardia, and they asked me to list everything that was in my handbag because my handbag was taken. So I went through Monedero and then I got to comb, and instead of saying peine, I said penne, which is a male part.
As are most words in Spanish.
So I had one of those in my bag. They all creased up laughing, so I just thought I'd bring a smile to your face.
Sharon, let me tell you something about the word penne, because when Penny came here 20 years ago, she started calling herself penne as well. Yes.
You thought that was hysterical.
It was really funny. But as you say, there is an equivalent for a body part in almost
everything. Be careful. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Sharon. So just this thing on language, Joe. What we've got here is we're talking about two real areas. We're talking about vocabulary for which one is familiar, whether you're a handyman or a tree surgeon or a language teacher or whatever. But then Janet started talking about pluperfect tenses and subjective tenses. Verbs are important, aren't they?
They are very, very important because they're the glue that stick everything together.
Absolutely.
And you can, as we said, get by pointing at things and attempting to name them. But if you want to have proper conversations and really interact, then you do need some grammar. You do need to make the effort to say, yesterday I was walking down the road when I saw somebody, or... or if you want to, you can, and all of the more complex constructions that we need. And then you'll become more confident. And as Janet said, yes, you need the building blocks, and then you can create with them and you can put them together.
We've got another caller on the line. Hello, good morning. You're live at Home with the Hogs.
Hello, good morning.
Yes, hi, good morning.
This is Peter from Murcia in Spanish.
Oh, Peter, buenos dias.
Buenos dias. I can't believe that was really quick. I just wanted to tell you something. I have been living there in Joe, marvelous country, UK, in Ashford by the side of the M20.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after 5 years living there, now I am here in Murcia again. Now I can understand how difficult it is listen and understand properly, because we are not speaking just about the language, we are speaking about the culture. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now I can feel how is UK citizens before to go to the time that I was living there. I didn't understand why this English citizen look at me like with the eyes, big eyes. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah.
And he didn't understand. Now I can understand.
Yeah.
When I was there, I have to tell you, after 5 years, I still couldn't understand everywhere and everything properly. And now I understand why you, English citizens, and why and how difficult it is for you.
That's very kind.
Thank you.
Very open-minded of you, Peter. Thank you very much for telling us that.
Sweet, man. Thank you so much. Thank you. Very, very sympathetic of you, and we really appreciate it.
And we are happy that you enjoyed your time in England too.
Yeah.
Yes, that was really nice. But I wanted to tell you something more. When I speak with friends of mine here in Murcia, and they say, no, the English citizens are living here, and they never learned our language. Mm. You don't know what are you speaking about.
Mm.
Try to go there and understand there. You know, this is really difficult.
Yes.
Difficult, Mike. I just wanted to tell you this.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Very nice to hear from you. Have a very nice day. I really appreciate the call.
And I know that we do have this reputation, but I think I'd like to add to what Peter says, in that we find in the village that we live that Spanish people are very tolerant of us and are very helpful and kind and very patient. In putting up with our attempts and struggles to form sentences.
And be prepared to giggle, but also, I mean, I've said this before, but I tend to bore myself with this, and I say it to countless people, do the simple things well. So if you can if you can learn to socialise, good morning, good evening, good afternoon, and you can stop and do that, you'll find that gives you confidence. With confidence, you can do a little bit more with the language.
Mm. And because living in a pueblo, it is far more obligatory for you to learn Spanish, isn't it? Otherwise, you really are nowhere.
You're lost. Yeah. You're completely lost.
Yes. Would it, Robbie, have been easier for you to have moved to Australia or Canada or South Africa and not bothered with the language?
Oh, yeah.
Or is the language fun?
To me, it's fun. To me, have a go. But of course it would be easier. I mean, Australia is a beautiful country, South Africa is a beautiful country, but it isn't Spain. And one of the most important things about here is the cultural thing. I think Peter nudged upon it. You know, the importance of the culture, the importance of understanding that. That's almost as important as learning the language, because if you respect culture and understanding, you've got to be a bit sympathetic. And when you're sympathetic, you tend to learn a lot more. And I think that's also very important. And the English that are here, and I know a lot of them really try and they struggle with it, but that just you go up so much in locals' estimations when you do have a go.
You are an extrovert though, Robbie.
Yeah, that helps.
And that certainly does help. You're very confident, you're an extrovert. For the quieter person, it's not so easy.
No.
It's really not easy.
I think that's very true.
And you're also a bloke.
Mm.
And that's easier as well.
Yeah, much easier.
I mean, it's no excuse, but I'm just saying, if you have that in your character and you're a guy, then you know you're less exposed in a way. I think that's
and the ability to act out to become a different persona. Janet's called us back from Mallorca. Hi, Janet.
I'm sorry, it's your correspondent from Mallorca again. His very wise words are being said at the moment. Thank you.
Oh.
And it's true. Don't worry about making a fool of yourself.
Mm.
Just just speak and speak. Mm. They'll tell you if it's wrong.
Yeah.
They'll tell you if it's wrong. And also, I must admit, I have never actually been in with the British community, the expats here. It was never my scene.
Mm.
So please try something new. Go to Spanish restaurants.
Mm.
Go to Spanish places. Don't stay around the expat community because you'll never learn.
Yeah.
Because those restaurants and those bars and those shops will all talk to you in English.
Yeah.
Mm. And we are endlessly blessed by our hosts who are essentially quite forgiving, aren't they?
They are very much so. They are far too forgiving.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I remember when I first came over here, I was really trying to speak Spanish, and the lady in the shop said, "Do you mind if we speak English? It's easier."
And that's so awful, you know, when that happens.
But yes, I mean, that was the first time, but I think it's that you've got to make the effort and try different things and different places, and it doesn't matter if they could laugh with them. Because it is funny. Mm. When you realise what you've said, then you think, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
You know, but then it's fun.
Words of encouragement. Thank you very much, Janet.
Thank you, Janet.
Having a go. I mean, just to wrap up this language thing, because it's obviously a major element in our lives in Spain. Living in Spain and not having total command of the language is, I think, a bit like the Book of Revelation, when St. Paul writes about seeing through a glass darkly,
yes,
and waiting for the lifting of some sort of veil of comprehension. But, Joe, do you think some people enjoy actually being slightly remote, being of the world of not understanding, of looking through that glass darkly, almost like a refuge position? Well, I don't know what's going on. You're being bombarded by so much information. If you don't understand the information you're being bombarded with, somehow it's less of a bombardment.
I'm not sure, because I'm such a joiner in it myself, but I do think that there is something about living in a foreign country which adds a sort of underlying tension to your life that you can sometimes feed off, and it does allow you to be a step back from everything that you're observing, so you can avoid engagement that can be confusing. If you're too engaged with things and too much involved in everything, you don't have the objective distance on
it.
And I think being an outsider in a community can give you that, and I think you often, if you're observing people and you can't hear everything they're saying, you use different intuitions to make assessments about them, and you look at their body language and you look at the way that they are acting rather than being kind of seduced by what they may be saying. So there is a kind of interesting sort of standing off position,
yes,
that some people might like, and it might suit some personalities to not be
sure. And you remain somehow exotic within your pueblo, don't you? I mean, is there kudos in that?
Is that what they call it these days?
Thank you, Robbie. I'm entirely exotic. There is that sort of difference that's always there, isn't there? I mean, I enjoy waking up even now, and I've been here 5 years now, and think, oh, yeah, I'm still in Spain. There's a palm tree. So that certainly, I suppose, we must also remain. And I think our village is very tolerant of us, because there is a sizeable community.
It didn't always used to be.
No.
Because there used to be quite a few people who had drank too much, misbehaved, and they were definitely looked down upon or looked terrible, really, physically did not come up to the mark. You know, I mean, the guys that we work for, and if they got work clothes, they won't go to a bar completely filthy like we would. They would always go home and wash and come back. But I remember I'd just been here a few months, many years ago, and there was a woman here who called Vicky. I remember seeing her in the bank, and we just immediately, you see somebody you have the same language as, and you're rabbit. Particularly if you get on quite well. And she looked at me and she said, "So they can see now," because other people are obviously listening, though you feel rude talking your own language, that we can have a giggle as well, because we suddenly come to life. It's like you arrive at Gap Gatwick or Heathrow, and you, suddenly you can pick up people or what they're saying, or you can eavesdrop, really, and you feel so much more engaged, not necessarily that you want to.
Empowered.
Like, hi.
When you can actually hear without listening, that's what I call it. So when you go back to England, you can hear snippets of conversation.
You filter it, don't you?
In Spain, I still have to really make an effort to tune my ear in to listen to what
Let's. We're going to have to stop for a break quite soon. I'm sorry, we've got another one coming up before the hour. But let's move on from language now and talk about the expatriate relationship with drink. Now, I remember years ago, before we moved here, calling a friend who was living in Javier and asking him how he was enjoying his life here in Spain. And he said to me, "Well, I'm not an alcoholic yet."
I'm working on it.
Has your relationship with drink changed since you've lived here, Joe? I mean, it's cheap, it's available. You can buy a bottle of Carver for very much less than an exclusive bottle of water.
Yeah, I mean, it is.
Is that a slippery slope, or?
Well, it appears to me that it is kind of more readily available, and that you are, you know, within staggering distance of many bars, and then there's always some event happening, which is some excuse for imbibing. I think you maybe do have to be a bit more aware of it and go out of your way to have a day off or just stay in, because it's a big occupational hazard in the village to set off to buy a bag of onions at half
come
past
back
five.
Drunk.
Drunk at half past ten. This has been known to happen, so I think you have to really go out of your way to avoid that and make do. Parameters
up. But the thing that I've noticed with a lot of expats is I think the rule of the road might be, look at the locals. What are they doing? Is this, if you want to fit in, is this acceptable behaviour to be pie-eyed at 1:30 in the afternoon in the middle of the square? You're allowed. I'm not saying don't do it. That's not what I'm saying, because I've done it. I'm the first to admit to it. But just be aware that the Spanish attitude towards drink is different.
Mm. Okay, so how do you perceive it?
This sounds very almost sexist. Please forgive me when I say this.
Go for it.
When we are in Galsin, and especially Joe and I, we regularly have a little tipple together, because Joe hardly drinks. It hits the back of her throat first and all that nonsense. However, you will see ladies, lovely, lovely Spanish ladies, lunch hour, and they are having a cup of coffee. They're out together having a cup of coffee, maybe a small beer, but nothing more like a bottle of wine, like we used to sit with great big vase of wine sat there
at lunchtime,
having a right old time. Now, would they frown upon it? They would think that's different, but I think we have to be a wee bit careful on how we do this. Now, holidaymakers are different, I fully accept that, but if you live here, respecting that bit of culture is also quite important for your own respects.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I make the mistake for the first years, most tourists do. We come here and get PISSED'd all the time because we think we're on holiday. But actually, the reality is, when you live here, you've got to fit in and you've got to be seen to be part of the community. And drink is an important part. But don't overdo it.
And also how you handle your drink.
And how you behave as a result, And I think there's a sort of misconception that Spanish people, particularly men, maybe start drinking really early and are always drinking. But I think that actually if you observe what happens is that people might have a little livener quite early at breakfast time, and then maybe another little livener when they have this later breakfast, you know, mid-morning. But then they're back at work, and that's it. So I think for them, as alcohol kind of punctuates the day, whereas we tend more to start drinking and then carry on till we fall over. Whereas I think with the Spanish, it goes with a meal, it goes with a little pause.
It's more of
in
a drip, effect, isn't it? More of a moistening rather than a torrent.
Rather than a soaking.
And more of a food in a way.
Yeah.
Actually, as a tonic, boof.
And very associated with food.
Aguardiente is it's not a nice thing to drink, but it's definitely a lift, like you would have coffee. I don't know.
If I got 30 to give you an example, a friend of mine in Galsin had the same thing happen to him as I had to me. Roaringly drunk one evening, thought I was the next, you know, Caruso, singing my heart out, staggering up the road.
waving at people I've never seen before, giving the full aria, you know, knocking on doors, the whole... Anyway, got back to my house, staggered back in, went to bed, thought nothing of it. Until 8:30 in the morning, one of my Spanish neighbours was on the door. 8:30. So I literally only got in at 4. Mm. 8:30, staggered in, and she stood there. She looked like the off Tom and Jerry. She just her hands on her hips, house coat on. Staring me straight in the face. Ooh, straight in the face like
how
that.
Scary.
And she said in those uncertain terms, "You live here," she said in Spanish. You do not do that. Now go back to bed. I will cook you something to eat to sober you up. You should be disgraced by your behaviour.
Ashamed of yourself, Robbie.
I was literally taken back in and told off. There you go. I mean, that's in essence what can happen.
Right. Yeah. The code of behaviour. Scary and bleary. We're going to have to take a break now. We'll be back with banks, bureaucracy and a sense of home on this survey of expatriate life in Spain after these messages.
Mr. and Mrs. Hogg, sponsored by Arbalista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com. At home with the Hogs. With Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
And welcome back. We're talking our lives in Spain, an unashamed indulgence in the expatriate experience of life in Spain. We were going to talk about bureaucracy, but we've had a little bit of a conflab while those messages were happening, and we've decided to press on with something slightly lighter. We're going to talk about food, Spanish food, food in Spain. Joe, are you a fan?
Oh, yes, very much so. Well, I have a reputation for never eating, which is entirely unfounded. But I do find Spanish food very easy to eat. What I like about...
Can we start with breakfast?
Well, we can certainly start with breakfast. Well,
like lard?
Basically lard, yes. Well, I'm sure everyone's seen the great big slatherings of that. Chewy bits of meat and
mantecas,
zarango, isn't it called? Personally, I love it, but then I'm from Yorkshire. I was raised on lard with everything, so that's not a problem for
Did
me.
Did you have dripping for breakfast?
I had absolutely.
Yeah.
Dripping toast, one of my absolute staple in our house. Pork dripping toast, jelly. Delicious. Yeah. So I'm quite tolerant for these kind of high cholesterol, fatty things. I enjoyed them. But I must say that my normal breakfast is usually tostada con tomates, which is so delicious with, with this scraped garlic.
Garlic, yes.
Scraped garlic on toast, slathered with olive oil, fresh tomatoes. I'm not mad on that pulpy thing that you can get.
And while we're talking about the combination between oil and bread, I read an interesting thing. I think it was Jan Morris who wrote that Spanish bread is not endemically suited to butter.
It's not designed for butter.
It's designed for oil. I thought that was really interesting.
Because the nice bread, the local Spanish bread that is quite grainy and quite solid sort of bread, isn't it?
Oh yeah,
you need it. And it's perfect for supping up delicious olive oil.
Yeah.
Listen to me. I'm sounding like a foodie.
You are. Let's
have it. And I think also I like the fact that in Spain, in our village, it is essentially local vegetables. You don't. It's not like on the coast where you can go into a massive Carrefour and get, anything.
Absolutely, anywhere.
Raspberries in January.
Avocados from Peru, for example. Yeah. And here we are in Spain.
In Spain.
So we have things in season, and you have things, and you can tell what time of year it is by what's available.
What's for sale.
Which I find, I like that, because that also reminds me of my childhood. And then, essentially, the Spanish food that's available in the village is quite simple and straightforward, so it's meat and vegetables and potatoes and all kind of fresh and local. I find that very enjoyable.
Moving on from breakfast, let's talk about the menu del día at lunchtime. I mean, it was a Franco legacy that the working man should have a fortifying and affordable lunch, and Venters were to offer menus. Rob, are you a fan of menu del día?
I do. I actually, because
you get to know where the good places are to do the Menil Daldia, and they are, you know where they are. They're between 7 and 9 euros. It includes a glass of wine. I mean, you can't really go too far wrong. If you ask,
oh, I don't know. Well, I don't know. You have probably have to do the.
No,
I'm
with
Penn.
How about
Flan? I am with Penn on that one. There are some super indifferent men in there.
Yeah.
We like the cantina.
School deer slop.
Yeah.
I mean, with indifferent service. All service that leaves you abandoned and hopeless.
Yes, quite often happens. I mean, when I do a Menil del Deer, it's because I've just done a walk or something.
Yeah.
Or my partner Jonathan knows exactly where to go. And that where food is concerned, he can sniff it out. So we always go to this one place. He has a Menil del Deer, and he always gets exactly what he wants. Because he can talk to him and say, "Well, I don't want this. I want this. I want that." And it's always about 9 euros. Mm. Now, I think it's because he's out and about working 24/7. He knows where they are. I think you're right, Kit. There are places that go, because they'll come out with what have you got on the menu, and they say chicken, pig. Yeah. Cow, and that's it. Hide of the cow, really, and that's it. It comes out a bit of a jollop. So it is touch and go. But I've actually had very pleasant experiences with Menil del Deer.
Me too.
Okay, what about moving on to dinner now? What about traditional posh, like suckling lechera, pig or lamb? Have you ever had that in the north of Spain? When this small,
we nearly had suckling pig, didn't we?
It's kind of like a fetus. Yes, it is on your plate.
And
I tell you what. Well, have you had it?
No.
No, the photos were just off. We were in Salamanca. And it's a speciality in Salamanca.
Absolutely.
And a friend of mine said, if you go to Salamanca, you have to have the suckling pig.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
And we saw these photos outside the restaurant, and we found it not appealing.
No, I mean, you could be a meat eater
get
a suckling pig eater. I started one in Segovia one time, and it tasted for all the world like human flesh.
Yeah.
Imagine what human flesh tastes like.
I think it's a bit too reminiscent of babies.
And it's not, you don't need to eat that. You don't need to eat these little creatures.
Which
it's
I did see
crazy.
Actually on the menu, grilled babies. And it was, should have
summed
been,
it up.
It was a mistranslation. I think it was meant to be baby,
lamb?
No, not prawns. What are the, calamari's things? Shrimp? No, not shrimp. What are they called? With tentacles.
Squid.
Squid. It was meant to say baby squid.
Are they called
squid?
Yeah.
And so it was translated as grilled babies, which.
We're getting seriously short of time now, but we can just finish talking about Spanish food by paying tribute to the tapas.
Yeah.
I think it is the tapas that is the
cure.
PS,
it is the most important.
La cocina española. Your favourite tapas, Joe?
Oh gosh, I like those little seafood salads with the pepper and. Chopped up peppers and
bits of... Bit of octopus.
And baby squid,
There's this little fish, don't they? Little fish in oil, which I absolutely love on bread.
The pocaronis.
Yeah, pocaronis. Mm. The pig's cheeks, superb.
Are you a pig cheek fan?
I never thought I would be, because I like to think I'm not that much of a meat eater, but I will have a go at pig's cheeks.
Why not?
Why not? Life's too short.
It's such a lovely thing, the tapas, that it's always available. So even though the... kitchen hours are always very strict in Spanish cafes and restaurants. There's always a tapas.
It's always a tapas.
Whatever time of the day, you can always accompany your little manzanilla with a tasty thing. I think tapas is...
What's your favourite tapas?
I have to pay tribute to jamón, Spanish jamón. I mean, we've talked about eating pig suckling. It's a world away for me from Spanish jamón. I know it's both meat, but jamón is a symbiosis of an agriculture I really love as well. Apart from tasting delicious, you've got oaks dropping acorns in the dehesas and free range pigs having the love of a
ride, completely different.
Munching these acorns until one day they get knocked on the head. What can you say?
And they make lovely hams.
Exactly. Look, I'm so sorry, guys. That's all we have time for. It's been absolutely loving you. Lovely having you here.
Can we come back here? We promise we won't swear.
Robbie and Joe, just try and make it on time next time.
We'll
go, go to the right Big Whopper. Yeah. Talking Spanish food.
Thanks for having us.
And we will carry on this discussion another time because there's so much more to talk about. Yeah. We haven't touched on abandoned dogs, for example. Yeah. Bureaucracy, sorry. Banks, or indeed a sense of home. Wow. So, Bates, you want to say anything?
Yeah, goodbye, and we'll see you next Saturday.
Yeah, we look forward to it. Bye. Thank you very much to Alan Parker.
Yes, Alan Parks.
Sorry, Alan Parks.
Yes, walking with alpacas.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah. Yes.
Absolutely brilliant.
You weren't listening then?
No.
No, okay.
We're trying to find where you were.
It's kind of the turn off.
In the meantime, we're going to just hear our blackbird as he goes out. There he is. Have a lovely weekend.
Have a lovely weekend.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.